folks born made to wave the flag. Oh, they're red, white, and blue. But when the band plays Hail to the Chief, they point the cannon right at you. It ain't me, it ain't me, I ain't no senator's son. It ain't me, it ain't me, I ain't no fortunate one. Some folks are born.
That's a little bit of Fortunate Son. That's Todd Snyder. We use it as the introduction to Activist Radio. We offer a little history you didn't learn in high school. We have some news items you haven't seen on your TV. We have a couple songs to help you join the resistance. We're on the web at Class Wars. Take a look at that. You can listen to us our last 10 programs as a podcast on Class Wars as well. Our guest today, well, actually we have several guests today. And we're going to start the program with two Vassar students, and I'm going to let them either introduce themselves or defer their names, because they're going to talk about really a hot issue here at Vassar College, and that's the recent vote for BDS. So why don't we go right into the interview, and I will thank the two students who came here. And were you two on the Wednesday program as well, or was that other students who came and talked from Ferguson to Palestine on Wednesday? Were you on the radio? You didn't come, so you're okay, great. So thank you so much for coming, and it's just a topic that has fascinated us, you know, for at least 6 months, seeing this vote come down the pike and seeing the publicity. God, you got the Wall Street Journal in it, the whole thing. And did you read the article in Haaretz yesterday? Wasn't that amazing that they would send a reporter to campus to interview Jewish students to see if there was a hostile environment? I mean, you guys got coverage nobody even expected. So welcome to Activist Radio, and maybe I'll start with the first question. Did you really get all that publicity yourself, or was that just fortuitous, or was that just luck? I mean, how did you get that much publicity on this? You have to come a little bit closer. Okay.
I don't know if I would say it was luck necessarily, but it wasn't on purpose either. I think those things, most of those things just came about because of increased attention on our campus.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't say it was either luck either, because lots of it definitely wasn't fair to our organization or movement either.
Well, I thought the Haaretz article was extremely fair, though, wasn't it? I mean,
mm-hmm. No, yeah, that,
yeah,
was,
that
sure,
was a good article. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's amazing to go through this this crisis on campus, and coming up to the vote and the different implications of the vote. Has it just taken up both of your time completely, or not? Do you have any time to do your
It's been a lot of time for sure.
Yeah.
I think for all, I mean, I think I would say all parties involved.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely been I think our campaign, our BDS campaign this time, or this year really kicked off in September in terms of, doing a lot of the work that needed to get done in terms of, designing flyers and printing flyers and organizing people and planning our campaign. In the month of February, we had kind of planned and scheduled a sequence of events that were meant to build up a tempo around the issue on campus. So that was all very deliberative. And it definitely took up a lot of time for a number of our organizers, and it still is. Mm. Occupies a lot of mind space. At the same time, we're all also students, so we all have other students among other things, right? I mean, we all have other commitments, and
sure.
So we did find ways to make
students,
that work.
College, you have a lot of commitments and things to do. And go ahead.
Hi, this is Eli. Just possibly, we have many listeners in various places, and not everybody is familiar with BDS is. I mean, we all do know. Maybe one of you could briefly explain what BDS stands for, and also please explain to people who are listening what was the most recent activity that kind of sparked all of this attention.
So BDS is the Boycotts, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. The Palestinian people put out a call over 10 years ago, and it's endorsed by Palestinian civil society, and it calls for the boycott, divestment, and sanction of certain companies that profit off the occupation of Palestine. And so we brought this call to our own campus and specifically to our Vassar Student Association. So we put forth a resolution and an amendment. So the resolution called for our student association to endorse the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, and the amendment called for specific companies that the VSA would not be able to use their large budget towards. Mm-hmm. So among those companies are like G4S, Sabra Hummus, which is owned by the Strauss Group. So there was a whole list of organizations or corporations that and companies that we would have called for boycott or divestment from. And so last Sunday was the vote on this resolution and amendment, and the resolution passed, but the amendment did not. So that's the very brief version of what's been happening on campus.
Sure. I have a question. A lot of campuses approach this with demonstrations and various actions and rallying of the students. Both of your organizations, Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace, you went a different route. You really went the academic route. You brought in really high, very good scholars. You brought in plays. You brought in... You know, it wasn't confrontational. You were going towards the academic. Was that something you decided to do back in September as a better way to pursue this? Or was that, again, something that you hadn't really thought of?
I think kind of given the context of the campus, I mean, we're a residential campus. A liberal arts institution, a student body of maybe 2,500 people. So I think a lot of the agitation the student agitation that you see happening is happening at much larger universities, UCLA. I don't know, what comes to mind for me is the UC system, but also Columbia University, NYU, CUNY schools, the City University of New York schools, also SUNY State University. So like those students have definitely been involved in agitation,
mm-hmm. rallies and
rallies and such.
Right.
I think here we didn't. We just thought that given kind of the scale of our campus, that those strategies, while I think in terms of ideologically, there's no opposition to, mm-hmm. personally, I don't
right.
have any opposition
right.
to those kind of student agitation. I think that's well within the rights of students to do that. It just didn't, in my mind, and I think in the minds of other organizers, make sense for this campus. The idea of marching around main building here was a little...
Right.
Just didn't quite make sense, and so what was available to us was kind of like a pretty robust student, like the Vassar Student Association has a pretty robust budget to allow us to bring in speakers and things like that, which is pretty unique compared to other schools.
Right,
and so
we
went that route and took advantage of that by bringing in speakers and academics and poets and.
It's amazing what you brought in such a wonderful group of people. It made it become difficult to question or to object to what they were saying. I mean, the scholars, Dr. Reitz, is that the way you pronounce it? Dr. Reyes that came in. That was the one that was referred to in the Wall Street Journal. What's her name?
Oh,
I think you're talking about Jaspier Puar.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, these people have unassailable academic credentials, don't they? I mean, they've written books, they've gone through the vetting, and so it made your position actually, I think, a good deal stronger. Go ahead.
Actually, two quick questions. You mentioned the budget of the Vassar Students Association. It's my understanding that the president has made some threats in terms of taking that budgetary authority away from the students if they don't behave and play nicely. So what your thoughts might be on that question. And second question, BDS is a hot topic. I'm just curious what you would say to folks who take the approach, well, BDS, it spells the end of Israel, it's anti-Semitic, it's just horrible, and we can't go along with it. And aside from the fact that BDS is nonviolent, I think it's important to point that out. But maybe you could either answer one or both or neither of those questions, the one about your being defunded by the president, and secondly, why BDS is not such a threatening thing to the state of Israel.
In terms of the budget of the VSA, which is around $900,000, it came out about approximately like 3 or 4 days before we were going to go to vote last Sunday that the Board of Trustees, upon visiting Vassar, had told the VSA, our student association, that if they passed specifically the resolution, which would directly impact the money in the VSA, then the entire VSA would be defunded, therefore kind of rendering how it acts right now kind of void, because mostly the VC Finance Committee, which is completely made up by students, get to decide how the money is spent.
Right, right.
And so if this amendment passed, that power would be taken away from the students, which would, I think, really hurt the power of the VSA as an organization, as a representative body and a democratic body. And then do you want to take that?
Yeah, it was a threat, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely a threat because only the resolution passed. We're not necessarily dealing with that threat because the amendment didn't, and it was more directly associated with the amendment. But that isn't to say that that threat might not have affected the kind of like
the
democratic
outcome.
Voting power of those
sure.
VSA members. And I think that's really, really unfair to those members, and that's unfair to our student body.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
did you want to add something?
Well, just to
go
the
ahead.
Second question.
Yeah.
I mean, the second part of that question, I think, was opposition to BDS as a movement or as a political as political tactics, and I guess the question was framed as to whether or not it necessarily like spells the end for Israel or is necessarily anti-Israel, and I think that it's really, I think definitely it's unhelpful to frame BDS. I mean, speaking personally, in my mind, it's unhelpful to frame BDS and also sort of inaccurate to frame BDS as something that is anti-Israel necessarily.
I see.
It's something that is pro. I mean, the goals of the BDS movement are very clear, which are to secure rights for Palestinian refugees and also for Palestinian citizens of Israel, to dismantle the wall and other kind of institutionalized forms of militarism
right.
within the region, and kind of Israeli military aggression and things like that, which are institutionalized and have that sort of momentum behind
mm-hmm.
them. And the third part of that is securing the right of return for Palestinian
mm-hmm.
refugees to return to, and that's a right. It's an extension of a right. It's not necessarily meaning that a population of people will be forcibly relocated. It's acknowledging
right.
a historical injustice
right?
and extending a right. And so that's what the BDS movement is seeking to secure
mm-hmm.
very clearly. And so to frame that as being necessarily anti-Israel, in my mind, suggests, I mean, if those are the things that Israel, if being in opposition to those things, being in opposition to extending rights to Palestinian, being in opposition to dismantling militarism, if those are the things that are fundamental to Israel, then that's an issue with Israel
mm-hmm.
and with Israeli society and,
right.
and political institutions in some way. So it's the framing is not that BDS is anti-Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The framing is that BDS is pro rights and pro justice and
maybe holding our corporations up to a slightly higher standard, that maybe you shouldn't be selling bulldozers when they're used to destroy thousands of homes all over the West Bank. You know, it's a higher standard that, you know, doesn't really have a lot to do with Israel in a way. I mean, we want to hold our corporations to some ethical behavior, and they don't have that now. I have a question. Rebecca Volkholmerson came to campus, I can't remember whether it was 2006, when we were part of the Duchess Peace group. We brought her to campus, and she said such an interesting thing, and I hate to even paraphrase her, but she said this often. She said, what you're going to face on campuses across the country is a divide between, it's a generational divide, that the older Jewish people want to think of their religion in one way, and a younger generation are redefining what it means to be Jewish and not agreeing with the other generation. She said, "Is what you're facing here is a generational divide within the Jewish community itself." And that was quite a while ago to say those things, I think, and I think in some way very accurate. How much does it have to do with people being Jewish here on campus? Are the groups made up of Jewish or non-Jewish students? Is that an issue on campus? I mean, how much of this is a generational fight between, between people who sort of want to have Judaism stand for something different than apartheid? No, nobody wants to.
Okay. I don't know. I'm a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, mm-hmm. but like I'm both a dues-paying member of the like national organization and also a member of the student group here at Vassar, the Jewish Voice for Peace at Vassar College. So the question is whether or not
is part of this a generational battle for another younger generation asserting the rights to have an identity apart from apartheid Israel?
I think that partly it's accurate to say that generationally there's kind of a generational line or division in that younger younger Jewish people, but I think maybe also just younger people in the U.S. generally
tend to be,
I mean, you know, I think there are historical reasons for that, of course, right? Mm-hmm. Like generations of the 1960s and
sure.
And earlier were involved in kind of a different point in the kind of historical development mm-hmm. of Israel-Palestine. I think there are just different historical influences
sure.
on both generations. So I think in some ways it's accurate to say that, younger people are generally more critical or whatever or what have you. But that's not to like erase the participation of
right.
like it is a multi-generational
movement.
Yeah, and it's also kind of a multiplicitous movement in more ways than that. I think Jewish Voice for Peace and also Students for Justice in Palestine mm-hmm. and pro-Palestinian or Palestine solidarity activism more broadly is seeking to be multi-front and
exactly.
and multi-group and bringing kind of groups together in coalition. And of course that's problematic oftentimes mm-hmm. and is not easy to do, but
sure.
I think that's generally the goal. I think there is something of a generational mm-hmm. gap, but I think more than
there's
that.
More than that there.
There is more than that there,
absolutely. Thank you.
Well, as someone who's many, many generations away from you young folks, I certainly have so much admiration for the work that you're doing. I grew up in a time when Israel was kind of the shining light on the hill. And we thought that everything that Israel did was wonderful, you know, it was a place for people without a land, you know, land for that whole rationale and the kibbutzes. It was making the desert bloom and all of that wonderful stuff. Until a point in my life when I realized that this was colonialism and it developed into an apartheid, violent, brutal state. At least a lot of the policies are. I'm just curious, in your own experiences, what brought you to the point where you can, where you see Israel in this light of being an apartheid state, where it needs, we need groups like SJP and we need actions like BDS to kind of urge Israel in the strongest way to change those factors that make it an apartheid, brutal state. What happened in your lives? Did you grow up with this? Was there some, you know, catalytic event or cataclysmic effect that, or something that happened? I mean, how did you, not that I want to hear your whole life, I would like to hear your whole life story, but maybe briefly, how is it that you ended up in this particular place with this particular position? What happened?
I had a great high school teacher who assigned, it was like, I think it was sophomore year, and we were all assigned, it was in the midst of the Arab Spring, and we were all assigned to study a specific Arab country, Middle Eastern country, and I was assigned Palestine, so I learned about Palestine's history from the Palestinian perspective, and so I kind of had that early entry into it, because I'm not a Jewish person, and I'm also white, so there's not, like, kind of an identity. So I don't have an identity affiliation with either place, either Israel or Palestine. And then I think also specifically over the summer of 2014, Operation Protective Edge, and I think that was just a very blatant display of Israel's occupation of and violence towards Palestinian people and land, and kind of bringing that to the world stage and kind of making that it kind of undeniable, something
confirming
you can't erase.
Confirming what you'd learn in high school.
Yeah, confirming what I learned and making it something that I couldn't necessarily be okay with ignoring and remaining complicit in.
That's so interesting.
And so I think then I came back to campus kind of with a more of a drive to do something about it and kind of grapple with my own as an American citizen complicity in the state of Israel and the way it operates and the kind of what it's guilty of too.
Right. All right. Yeah. Thank you very much. Do you want to take a try at that, or I mean, where do you want to talk about how you came to your conclusions about Israel? But I mean, we could pass on that if you wanted to.
I'll just try and be brief. I know I've been talking a lot, but I think, I think studying, I don't know, since getting to college and studying the history and studying, kind of coming to these understandings of how structure, political structures and social structures work in the world was really informative to me. You know, kind of meeting up with groups and getting involved with groups like JVP and meeting people involved with those groups was definitely really formative for me in terms of like, an outlook on the world or a world view, and a political view and things like that. So that's all been pretty recent for me in terms of like
the past few
years in terms of developing the language for those things and how best to like articulate things and stuff like that.
It's a huge compliment for Vassar College there. And I think all of your work is just showing how incredibly able you people are to frame ideas, to make a campaign that really looks to a lot of the colleges around the country as almost the way to go. I mean, this campaign has something about it that has had much more exposure than a lot of the other campaigns. I mean, it's happening in colleges all over the Hudson Valley and all over the country, but, you know, you've done a great campaign, and part of it is really a compliment to Vassar, I think. I mean, Vassar should be so proud of what you're doing. But a last question, quick question. So what's next? You won the VSA vote, but didn't get two-thirds for the amendment, which would have restricted VSA spending. What's the next step? Involving the whole students in a vote, or where do you go from here?
Well, even the resolution passing will probably go to an amendment. Not amendment, sorry, a referendum, which would mean that the entire student body
would
be able to vote on it. So, therefore, if the student body votes in a majority for it, it's a majority right now. Yeah, if they vote majority for it, then it stands.
Yeah.
And the VSA remains an organization that endorses BDS. But however, if it fails, if more students than not vote against it, then it won't stand in the VSA.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much. It was a short notice, and but you guys are versed in this, I can tell. I mean, when you think about it that much. Yeah, go ahead.
Now, I just wanted to say two things. One, I mean, you and I, Fred, as being the oldsters and the old generation, we can kind of relax a little bit. I'm just so impressed, and I have so much respect and admiration for you young folks coming in here and speaking so articulately and so well informed about the issues. And your energy and your campaigns are just inspiring. And I also think we're going to have to change what we say about the history you didn't learn in high school.
I know.
Because one of our guests learned about this in high school, so I'm just going to have to shut my mouth and
must have been a good
change
high
that.
Or a good teacher. So anyway, I want to thank you guys for coming in. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you. And, you know, good luck in your campaign. We'll definitely follow this campaign. It's such a... a nail biter. It's going to be a nail biter right to the end. So thanks.
Just
so much.
A final quick question. When might that vote where the full student body participates? Is that like next week, next year? Where does that come into it? And when might that happen? Or if you know.
I mean, I think the as I understand the process, the students would have to students in opposition to the resolution would have to deliver a petition to the VSA. And then with the petition in hand, the VSA would then bring it would put the vote onto the March ballot, which I think late March, the spring ballot for the for next year's elections or next semester's VSA elections. So it would be on that ballot. So possibly by the end of March, it's kind of yet to be seen if a petition will be delivered or how that'll play out, but that's sort of in our on our radar. I mean, that is on our radar, and only a part of our work right now.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much.
I really appreciate you
coming, and you guys can stay for the rest of the show if you want, but you probably have so much to do. I can't imagine that you do want to stay, but thanks so much, both
thank
of you,
you,
for doing that. All right. All right. We... going to have a very shortened little history. We're not even going to, talk about Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman died today, March 10th, 1913. This is also Harriet Tubman Day. We were going to tell you about some of her amazing exploits and her activism throughout her life. We're not going to do that. We're just going to go play a song for Harriet Tubman now. And one of my really sort of favorite songs by Nina Simone.
Hear, hear.
It's the song is called For Women. Let's hear Nina Simone on Harriet Tubman's birthday.
My skin is black, my arms are long, my hair is woolly, my back is strong, strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah. My name is Aunt Sarah. Aunt Sarah. My skin is yellow, my hair is long, between two worlds I do belong. My father was rich and white,
divorced my mother late one night. What do they call me? My name is Sophronia. My name is Sophronia. My skin is tan. My hair is fine. My hips invite you. My mouth like wine. Whose little girl am I? Anyone who has money to buy. What do they call me? My name is Sweet Thing. My name is Sweet Thing.
Of course, that's They Lied by Jay Mankita. This is the lead-in to the next part of our show, Fantasyland Media. And we do have a website. It's fantasylandmedia.org. And here we take a look at the failings of our corporate-controlled media, where all news is fashioned by the people in charge, the corporations, and your own government. Each week, we cover the stories that are just left out of the U.S. propaganda machine. The first story this week comes from The Guardian in the United Kingdom. Quote, Barack Obama has rescheduled a trip to Buenos Aires following criticism over his planned presence in the Argentinian capital on the 24th of March, which is the 40th anniversary of the brutal 1976 coup that installed a military dictatorship, which the United States initially supported. A military junta imposed martial law on March 24, 1976, and began killing thousands of mostly young opponents of the regime, and continued until democracy was restored in 1983. Adolfo Perez Esquivel, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his human rights work during the dictatorship, had warned that Obama's arrival would coincide with huge marches in commemoration of the victims of the coup and could even provoke confrontations. Obama represents a country, and this is a quote from Esquivel, Obama represents a country that was responsible for various military coups in Latin America, including those in Chile and Argentina, he told The Guardian. Now, of course, this is something that just came up recently the other night in the debates. They were talking to Bernie Sanders, and he was pointing out how the United States was involved not only in Honduras, but in Nicaragua, in Chile, of regime change, toppling governments, undermining governments, and engaging in illegal activities. Now, we're just wondering how the New York Times covered this story regarding Obama going to Argentina. The New York Times did not carry this story in its print edition and only had a toned-down Associated Press report on the New York Times website. Our newspaper of record has always sanitized the empire when it comes to overthrowing elected governments in the rest of the world. No wonder most U.S. citizens think that American foreign policy is based on human rights.
Yeah, when the media just never tells us, the overthrow, the dictatorship in Argentina was back in, 25, 30 years ago. But still, the New York Times, The Guardian can do it. A newspaper in England can give us the background of this. But our own New York Times can't give us the background that we were involved in that coup and supported the generals. Tell us about Operation Condor. It got a whole bunch of countries together to assassinate leftists all through South America. Why can't our media tell us what our foreign policy is? That's why people are so innocent that they're clueless about what the U.S. really does in the rest of the world. And we can't change things unless people start to realize what our foreign policy really is.
And people do forget. They forget, they talk about Iran and, the Ayatollahs and all this stuff. But the reality is that the United States went in there and overthrew the democratically elected leader in Iran, Mossadegh, back in the 50s. We're talking about regime change. We're busy changing regimes in Libya. We're busy changing regimes in Iraq. We're busy trying to change regimes in Syria. I mean, this is something that we engage in all of the time, all around the world. It's just, and the Times, of course, no mention.
This is from Mondo Weiss's second story here. While Europe may think of itself as part of an enlightened West, using aid to defend Palestinian rights, the reality is less reassuring. The aid may actually be making things significantly worse. Shir Haver, an Israeli economist who spent years piecing together the murky economics of the occupation, recently published a report that makes shocking reading. Like others, he believes international aid has allowed Israel to avoid footing the bill for its decades-old occupation, but he goes further. His astonishing conclusion, one that may surprise Israel's settlers, is that at least 78% of humanitarian aid intended for Palestinians ends up in Israeli coffers. Four-fifths of all the aid being given to Palestinians.
That's just like the water. All the Palestinian water ends up in the swimming pools of the settlers.
The sums involved are huge. The Palestinians under occupation are among the most aid-dependent in the world, receiving more than $2 billion from the international community a year. According to Hover, donors would be directly subsidizing up to a third of the occupation's costs. Well, the New York Times didn't print this story. Do you think the New York Times would print this story? Can you listen to this radio program for more than 3 or 4 weeks and not know that the New York Times would not print this story? It certainly sheds light on the pervasive corruption of Israelis' occupation, but in effect, it's news that the newspaper of record goes out of its way to avoid, again, sanitizing the empire, sanitizing Israel, which is part of the empire.
Do you think the people at the Times, do you think they've got like a special little room where they censor and review everything before it gets out? I mean, is this like a self-imposed censorship? What do you think happens?
They hire ideologues. I mean, look at who's reporting on Israel. They have close ties with the Israeli military. Isabel Kirshner, for example, her husband works in Israeli intelligence or has worked in intelligence. He works for a right-wing Israeli think tank in Washington. I mean, it's who they hire to do the reporting
But you know, those with those ties to Israel are throughout the media. I mean, you look at people like Wolf Blitzer.
That's
he was connected
right.
to, I forget if it was AIPAC or he was a spokesman for somebody, but it's throughout the media it's, that people in top high-profile positions have these direct links, and if they're not directly connected, their husband, their wife, yeah. or their child is serving in the IDF forces. It's really astonishing.
It's tricky because, you know, it is an old anti-Semitic statement, of
yes,
course, that
yes.
the media... And all rich people in the media are Jewish. You know, that's an anti-Semitic statement that was used by the Nazis, and you hear it from anti-Semites here in this country. So I think you have to be so careful, to avoid blanket statements like that, and also to acknowledge, you know, part of it's pro-Zionism, but part of it's pro-empire. Israel is the colony of the U.S. Empire given to us by Britain. You know, Israel is part of our military presence in the Middle East. How do you unwind that from a Zionist influence on the press? It's a difficult thing to unwind, I think. But
it's very tricky business.
Yeah.
It really is. And, you know, the really sad part about this is that a lot of Israel's current behavior in terms of the occupation and the brutality and what goes on day in and day out there, it just casts Israel in such a bad light. I mean, they're generating bad feelings toward Israel just by their own behavior, and that's just tragic.
It's tragic, and it's tragic on campus, too, because threatening the students to cut off the VSA funding for all their student activities unless they vote correctly on the BDS resolution, you know, that's a sort of a campus administration, I think that sort of lost touch. I mean, I feel like trying to advise them, such a bad move. You've spread this completely throughout campus. All the media, the campus papers, the one that just came out, The Observer, I mean, criticizes the president for heavy-handedness. And of course it's heavy-handed. Why did she really need to do this? And I'd put the category that she recently suggested that the comments in a talk brought in by an academic to Vassar was objectionable. She wasn't there.
Right.
I mean, how does she know it's objectionable? Did she read it in the Wall Street Journal? And therefore, how can an academic person pass judgment on somebody else's ideas if they haven't even, you know, read them or heard the talk in question? How does she know what the talk was about? I mean, I was there. The Wall Street Journal totally lied about what was in that speech, at least three inaccuracies about what she talked about. So I think the administration, really, they're not doing it. Even they're not even doing a good job protecting Israel. It's just so heavy-handed, very characteristic of AIPAC. You know, they overplay their hand.
Seems like it, yeah. Yes. And our last story. Do we have time for
Fred? Yeah.
This comes to us from The Guardian in the United Kingdom. Back to Latin America. Officials in Honduras have refused to allow the only witness to the murder of environmental activist Berta Cáceres to leave the country and return to his native Mexico. Gustavo Castro Soto, coordinator of Friends of the Earth Mexico and director of the NGO Otros Mundos, was shot twice during the attack on Cáceres on Thursday morning and only survived by playing dead. Officials are treating him as a protected witness, according to the AP, but activists say that the Honduran Attorney General's office had issued a 30-day immigration alert against him, preventing him from leaving the country. Cáceres' nephew, Silvio Carrillo, said that Soto was not allowed to sleep or change out of his bloodied clothes after the attack. The treatment of Castro, the treatment that he received for 3 days, was tantamount to abuse, he said, in an open letter published by the Honduran newspapers. Castro alleged the crime scene was altered while he was only offered medical attention 3 days after the attack. Now, the New York Times. No mention of the witness Gustavo Soto by the New York Times, and certainly no mention of the support the United States gave for overthrowing the elected president of Honduras. leading to yet another bloody dictatorship in Central America. Hillary Clinton was behind the U.S. coup, and that was omitted from the story as well.
Now, this is the new U.S. policy in Latin America. You know, Zelaya was elected. He was a real progressive, and he was overthrown by the military trained in the U.S. School of the Americas. So the military took over. Immediately, there was a fight within the administration, and Hillary Clinton prevailed. She was the hardliner that wanted to recognize the military dictatorship right away, and they did. And the result has been over 2.5 years of the worst, the bloodiest wave of assassinations of reporters, of union people, of students. Honduras is, has descended, into what many U.S.-supported dictatorships descend into, and it's chaos. But the New York Times doesn't want to tell you that story.
Well, and then when the people of Honduras are desperate to escape the chaos and the commotion and the killing in Honduras, and they want to get out of there, we're talking about building walls and nobody can come in, and tough luck for them, and they've got to stay there. Here they're living in this situation that was created to a large degree by United States recognition of a military coup conducted by military officers basically trained here in the United States at our good old School of the Americas.
And Tegucigalpa is an amazing place. I drove through it once in Honduras. I mean, there's an American base there that just you wouldn't believe. I think it's our biggest military base in Central America. And so we have such control over that country from our military base, and because we own all the, all the military people, we pay them directly, and it's our dictatorship. And I'm afraid the U.S. is going back to the bad old days where it creates these dictatorships. It's trying to destabilize Nicaragua. I can tell it in the Times. The Times now has anti-Nicaragua. This Sunday had an anti-Nicaragua article, like the people should rise up against Ortega, I think that the U.S. is moving really to the right as far as more warmongering, and of course that would be fit totally with what Hillary Clinton would be for.
Well, she's just going to kind of dyed in the wool, neoliberal iron lady.
Yeah.
But the fascinating thing is, if you look at Latin America, there seems to be movement to the left. I mean, you talk about Venezuela, of course, Cuba always. You talk about Ecuador. And in various places, there's definitely movement to...
A huge movement to the left, but they're, for example, trying to destabilize Venezuela.
Right.
Of course, we put new
sanctions. Is the revolution going to be televised?
I don't know. Wasn't that a wonderful movie?
Yes, it was. Do people know what we're talking about?
Yeah, the revolution will not be televised. These two Irish guys with a couple cameras got caught in the revolution against Chavez, right?
Hugo Chavez.
And, they made an amazing film of being right in the middle of it. 100,000 people climbing the walls, the military's running around. I mean...
And it was touch and go. I mean, it was the cinema verite, and it was actually these filmmakers were filming this as Hugo Chavez was being held a prisoner, basically.
Running.
And it was really kind of questionable whether this coup was actually going to work.
Yeah.
And it was, if I remember correctly in the film, it was only because of the loyalty of some of his military folks that he was able to free himself and stay in power.
Well, also, at the end of the movie, you went out to the courtyard and you looked. He took, a video of this, I think it was 200,000 or 300,000 people gathered around this palace, and it was as far as you could see their people, and they were climbing the walls, and I think that type of pressure, brought it to an end as well. They wanted their leader back. They'd elected him, and what right did America have of overthrowing their leader? What right do we have telling the rest of the world what to do, especially when the people we put in are such... it creates such bloodbaths.
Isn't that part of that whole exceptionalism story, Fred?
Sure,
that the United States, with the exceptionalism that we do have, that right to tell other countries what they can and cannot do, we can tell Iran, you can or you may or may not have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Israel, yes, you may have Israel. You may have nuclear weapons. Iran, no, you may not have nuclear weapons.
It all depends, I think, on the ignorance of the American people. And unfortunately, like Hillary and running against Bernie, I mean, it's really interesting. Neither one of them talk very much about the U.S. empire. Bernie does a little bit, but he's worried. He's scared of it. But I think deep down, when people do the history of this era, they will talk about the American empire and millions of people that were destroyed in our empire. I mean, that's the overriding intellectual idea that's going to be part of, you know, our generation of people in America. It's totally dependent on not knowing.
I mean, as you look around the world, Fred, you're right. You're talking about between 1 and 2 million Vietnamese innocents,
sure,
who were killed. I mean, in Iraq alone,
yeah,
we're talking about close to a million people.
Millions of people.
It's incredible. And people don't want to hear about that. But it's also, you know, we've got the 800 military bases around the world. We really have a stranglehold on the world. And now we're talking about shaking the saber at China because they're doing something in the islands over there.
And how about Africa? We're into Somalia.
AFRICOM is, you know,
sending troops all over the place in Africa. I think we're involved in wars in 7 countries. It may be 8. It goes up every. Hillary wants, of course, send them into Libya. And
well, she's all about regime change. I mean, you know, Libya, well, that was just wonderful, and Syria was wonderful, and Iraq was wonderful, and you know, it's just the human toll, the human tragedy, not just of the people living in these areas, but you know, our own military people, the men and women who get,
sure,
caught up in this. They come back physically disabled, mentally compromised,
sure,
no jobs, and the VA doesn't want to take care of them. It's
you
just disgraceful.
Murder for the empire, and you come back a wounded person. I don't think the wound is ever, you're able to heal that wound of killing somebody else for a lie. But anyway, we're going to go to some feedback we got from Mindy. I'm not going to give her last name. She said, I work for Adala in New York. That's a pro-Palestinian human rights organization. I recently came across your podcast and listened this morning. At the end, one of you said that people want to know what they can do, and one of you gave an impassioned plea, all right, Eli, to everyone listening to have our pets fixed and only buy them at shelters, which I've done. It's a wonderful suggestion. Thank you. But I'd like to suggest something simple that people can do regarding the anti-boycott legislation that we've talked about on the show. There's a coalition of groups working on combating the legislation, meeting with New York State legislators, writing op-eds in the New York papers, circulating a letter to be signed by at least 100 groups. Actually, over 120 groups have signed that letter. Will be given to legislators when they're done with the budget planning, likely at the end of March. Also, individuals are being asked to send a letter to their own member of the New York State Assembly through this link, and we're going to put the link right on Class Wars. That'll be your action for today. You can just get so wound up. Just you go to Class Wars, you click on that link, and oh my God, the revolution has started, right? So we're going to put it right there. Anyway, thank you so much, Mindy, for for bringing that up. And we got actually time for another quick song if you want, or do you have something you want to...
Fred, I always have things to say.
Oh, please.
You know, my wife complains, you know, that I talk too much and I talk too loudly. And well, certainly tonight, the Republican debate is on tonight. And last night, Bernie and Hillary were on. And I actually thought it was, I watch all of this. I'm way too connected to all of it. But last night, it was a very interesting debate with Hillary and Bernie. And Bernie seems to be gaining momentum. He seems to be gaining financial momentum as well as winning in Michigan. What's really fascinating, I mean, the debate was held on Univision, and the people actually asked some really difficult questions of Hillary about her trustworthiness, difficulties, about the possibility of being indicted, about the fact that people do not find her trustworthy. So it was really the first time that she was challenged in any real way.
Mm.
And kind of the fascinating thing about that is that the way the media, the mass corporate media, deals with this whole Bernie and Hillary thing. Here Bernie had this astonishing, almost unbelievable victory in Michigan. And the media, it's like, oh, ho-hum, you know, it's... Hillary's going to have to maybe readjust or tweak her campaign, but there's never an acknowledgement. And I'm not a huge Bernie fan. I mean, some of the domestic stuff is really great. I think his foreign policy kind of is really wanting in many areas, but the media just doesn't want to give him time or anything.
No, it's quite obvious. And the New York Times headline was Trump makes big victory, Sanders strong.
strong what? Strong smelling? Strong,
I don't know,
what is
that's
strong?
An, that's as pro-Bernie. And one story, I'll do it for next week, is fairness and accurate and reporting analysis of the Washington Post. In 16 hours, they had actually 16 stories about Sanders and Clinton. All 16 were negative on Bernie Sanders. They had carried no story that was favorable. And meanwhile, their opinion page is, all, of course, all for Hillary Clinton. But to have the news so subjective, you know, so far from what we think should be news, as 16 stories in 16 hours, that's the name of the headline, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. So that's going to be one of our stories when we come on next week. Well, we got about 30 seconds. I'm still thinking about those students, and I wouldn't want to be in their way.
No, I think, you know, they've got energy, they've got intelligence. They're certainly you know,
they're
activities.
Smart, they're so sure.
It's inspiring.
It's
really
inspiring.
Is. It gives us hope. Us old
it
guys,
does.
Some hope.
It does. We got to bring them back about every day, every week. Anyway.
Every day, that would be great.
All right, we need a little bit more. We'll see you next week.
All right.
Listen to Activist Radio on WVKR 91.3 FM in Poughkeepsie, New York. We're on every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. Also tune into Inside Hudson Valley Politics Friday mornings at 7 a.m. as well as from Ferguson to Palestine every other Wednesday at 5 p.m. Be sure to like Activist Radio on Facebook and check out our Class Wars blog for a look at today's interview. We'll be returning next week at the same time to help you become part of the resistance.